We had spoken last week of the section, the end of chapter 4, where he has a word for the merchandisers, the enterprisers. That, of course, does not have to mean people that are really engaged in business as such. Anyone on the earth with his or her private plans and ambitions and goals. And using the merchandiser as an example, he just says, "Come now, you that say, today or tomorrow we will go into such a city and buy and sell and get gain," and so on. He says, "Because you do not know what shall be tomorrow." You ought to say, he says, "If the Lord will, we shall live and do this or that." So the point is not that you are never at liberty to make plans. That would be not very practical. You are at liberty to make plans, but rather not to make them brazenly or boldly or indifferently to what Christ wants. The key there is the fact that if the Lord will, we shall live and do this or that. So without making it a cliche, we can always say, "Well, Lord, this is what I would like to do if you will, and if this is what you want, why, this is what I'd like to do, but I'm open to your changes or suggestions or whatever." And then James goes on to remind us we are, after all, like a vapor, a mist, appears for a time and then vanishes away. We think, as we focus in on our few short years of life, that life is such a long, drawn-out thing, that we're right in the middle of it. But as you look back over the pages of history, you're aware of how transient things are. If you do very much reading in history, for example, in the earlier ages of history, we will lop off 100 years in a plus or minus concept. For example, we say, well, the children of Israel left Egypt in 1300 or 1200 B.C., and in one sweep, we lop off more than your lifespan. See how quickly time is, how insignificant time is the further down the road you get. And life goes by so swiftly. And this, of course, is what James is talking about. So therefore, the whole thrust of this paragraph, going on into the fifth chapter, which we shall read more of tonight, the whole thrust of the paragraph is, since life is so transient, we are wise to make our focus on doing that which is of the Spirit, that which God wants. And it is never sound to make a decision on terms of just our own human understanding. That is true in terms even of guidance. You make your decisions in terms of what Christ wants. And I just said recently to someone, well, I have to say that I prayed about it, made that decision on the basis of what I thought Christ wants, and it's not open to negotiation. It's non-negotiable. If we negotiate our decisions in terms of emotions or something else, we weaken them, because we make our choice after what Christ wants, and nothing else really matters. I said this matter is not something that you can really apply logic to necessarily, but it's what we believe Christ wants, just the way it is. So that's the way we ought to face all of our decision-making. None of us is smart enough to live. Parents are not smart enough to discipline their children. They're not wise enough to know what is right and what isn't right. And all through our own life with our own children, we had to make our decisions not on what we thought was wise, but what we felt Christ wanted us to do. And when I prayed about a decision and got what I thought was the mind of the Lord, I'm obviously not infallible, but what I thought was the mind of the Lord, that's the decision I made, and it was non-negotiable. No is always no, not maybe if you can come up with better reasons. It was not negotiable. This is what Christ wants, is what he wants. And I wasn't smart enough to go over his head on these decisions. I've always said, I've said to you before, I'm going to mention it again because it's a good principle that you can always follow. If you've used careful judgment to make a decision, or if you looked at all the possibilities and made a sound reason, don't ever change it because of an emotional pressure from anyone. If it was sound when you made it, it's just as sound in the midst of emotional interactions. Don't ever change those decisions just for emotion's sake. I made a certain decision not too long ago that I felt was what the Lord wanted. I made that decision, then additional facts came to light later, and I was going to reconsider, and I thought, no, I'm not going to reconsider. If the Lord had wanted me to know those facts earlier, he'd have let me know the facts earlier, and I would have made a different decision, but he didn't let me in on it. I have to keep my decision the same. Now, you think about that here. You've got to make a decision of some kind, and you pray, and you ask the Lord for guidance. You've looked at all the options, and then you make your choice. All right, this is what I think the Lord wants. Then later on, additional information comes to light. Now, the chances are you should overlook that additional information. It's either it's unsound or it shouldn't affect the situation. It may look like it ought to affect it, but in God's mind, it doesn't affect it. If you had known before, you'd have maybe made a wrong decision. You'd have made a different decision, see? Don't ever change in the midst of just emotional interaction or in the midst of facts that could have been brought to light earlier if the Lord had wanted to bring them to light earlier. The very fact that he kept those facts from you indicated that he didn't want them to be part of the choice. That's very solid thinking. It's especially good with your young people because then you have no regrets. You make your decision, you say yes or no, or you make your decision in terms of your own life, and you don't change it. I brought all of that out because, you see, our whole thing is decision-making. That's where we're all, where it all comes down to the nitty-gritty. How do you make wise decisions? Because we're confronted with them constantly. Career decisions for the younger people, marriage decisions, decisions about relationships with others, decisions about jobs, lesser decisions about whether to go on a particular trip or not, whether to make this move or that move. We're all in the midst and process of decision making. I say to you, don't ever make a decision of any consequence at all, certainly, apart from asking the guidance of Christ. But take that guidance seriously. Don't ask and then listen to Satan or listen to somebody else. It's an insult to the Lord for you to ask for his guidance and then make an alternate decision. That's an insult to Christ. I had given a certain individual charge of a matter, of a certain area. They'd made a decision about a matter, and the person about whom the decision was made wanted to go over their head and come to me, you know. And I said, no, I said, I gave them that authority, and I said, they prayed about it, and they felt that was the decision to make, and I said, I'm going to stand by them, because I said, if I were to go over them and say that maybe they didn't make a wise decision, I would destroy their confidence in Christ and in their own capacity to make a choice. So I said, I'm going to just stick by their decision in the matter. If you ask for Christ's guidance, then follow it. Let's take the issue of the parent and child relationship. Parent and young person. Parental problems are often very serious here. So the parent asks guidance of Christ. They say, now, Lord, give me guidance about this matter. Maybe the person, young person wants to go somewhere. And you have a sense that they shouldn't go. You've asked for guidance. And to the best of your guidance, you're uneasy about their going. So you say, no, I can't let you go, because this is what I've asked prayer for, and this is the way I feel about it, and I'm going to have to go on that conviction. And you'll be more likely to be right on that than to then, after you've prayed, try to employ reason or listen to their reasons. That's one illustration. Another illustration might be relative to a job matter. You have a job opportunity. You pray and ask Christ to guide you in this job. You put the matter before him, and then you may be a little uncertain, and yet when the time comes up to make the decision, you say, now, Lord, just see that I make the right decision. The time comes to make it, and you make it. Now, maybe you have sensed that the Lord wants you not to take the job, for example. You just don't feel easy about taking it. You say, well, Satan confuses in our feelings. He can, except that if you are asking Christ for guidance, you're just going to have to depend on the Lord to protect you from that. And so you say no. Now let's say they come back with more money. bigger offer. What's your answer then? No. Answer's no. If some friend comes along and says, oh, you were foolish not to take that because look at all the advantages. And so you say, well, all right, I'll reconsider. No, don't reconsider. Just no. And suddenly bills come up and you say, oh, if I'd only taken that job, you know, bills are coming up. You say, no. You asked for guidance. You had a sense within you of what to do and you did it. But you don't go for any further guidance than that. If you push on a thing long enough, you can, the Lord will stand back and let you go. Now, maybe the choice on the other hand is yes. Maybe you say, well, I think I should take this job. So you take it, and then things don't seem to look very good, you know. And you say, well, I took this job, and now look at the things that have happened to me. If you pray about a matter, when it comes time to make the decision, you make it and trust Him to see that you make the right one. And don't go back on it. Let me go on to remind you of what I've said many times before. Even if you are wise enough, let us say that by computerized accuracy, you have made absolutely the best possible decision. Even then, a human decision can be wrong. Perhaps you're going to go to work for a certain company. Make that choice. You go to work for them. But then shortly thereafter, the company gets into financial difficulty and you never knew anything about it yourself. Yet as the thing looked, you made a very wise choice. But then you didn't know what's going to happen. Maybe the owner dies and the place goes bankrupt. You know, you don't know what's going to happen. There's so many things that you don't know about as a human being that even if you are wise as you can be, you need a divine assistance in these decisions. Now, I'm not talking about deciding whether you're going to wash the dishes now or do the ironing, you know, or whether you should hold the rutabagas today or the rose bushes or something. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the decisions that have any significance at all. And you have to make that choice. If you think a relationship to another human being, which has to do with borrowing a cup of sugar, might have importance to it, it's fine. Pray about it. You have to make the choice of what you think is important to you in your life and what isn't. But generally speaking, decisions you make that have to do with your relation to others or with your future welfare and so forth, these are all must be made with Christ. Now, there is a point at which you may need outside assistance in that. That's something that people like myself are around for, among some other things. But if you come to me, then what I have the responsibility of doing is not just laying before you all the options, because you could already do that, or just being the devil's advocate, as they say, and trying to show you the bad points. My job is to pray with you and try to come to terms with Christ as to what seems the sound way to go. There are times when I have definite conviction that this is the course of action that ought to be followed. Now, a person that would come to me and take up my time just to get a few other suggestions would be wasting my time. The person that comes to me thinking that I'm just another human voice to listen, if you're getting opinions from two or three other people and you also want to get my opinion on the matter, don't bother me. It's not my job to just give human opinions. Now, that's a tough situation for me to be in. I either represent Christ or I don't. If I don't represent Christ, don't come to me because I'll lead you astray. If I do represent Christ, then listen to what I say. It's that clear cut. Of course, we're used to the world's approach to things, which is to get a dozen opinions and bat them around like a racquetball, you know, and come to some sloppy conclusion about it and go our faulty way. If you go to someone who's got enough experience and knowledge, even if they, you know, you may not be sure they're altogether coming from Christ, but the chances of them making a sounder decision are certainly better. Probably in your own, just like in medical matters. The doctor may not be infallible, but he's probably a lot more qualified to make a judgment than you are about yourself. You put up with a margin of error there and say, well, he might be wrong, but on the other hand, he's more likely to be right than I am. But I feel that people ought to either come to a person like myself or guidance, either ought to come seriously, ready to be open about it or just not bother. Because, you know, again, if people come and talk to me and then they decide for themselves they didn't need to talk in the first place. In other words, if a person comes to me and the only things they follow are the things they agree with, they didn't need to come in the first place. I've often said the difference between a professional and an amateur is the ability to see beyond the obvious. The obvious stuff you can see. You know, he's coming to me. It's the stuff beyond the obvious, the stuff you may not agree with simply because you haven't been around long enough or haven't had enough experience. You know, nobody, as I say, nobody has to come to me and nobody has to talk to me at all. But if a person comes to me, they ought to come either if they come to me sensing that the Lord wants them to come to me, then they ought to listen. If they don't have that sense, then they ought to go to somebody else. It's all right with me. I'm not going to be unhappy. All of that down the road, down this one direction, that life is too crucial. You only come through once. The word from the beer people that since you only go around once, you ought to do it with gusto, is faulty. That's faulty. I don't think that the Madison Avenue people are really qualified to tell you what you ought to do with your life. That's not the biblical thought. The biblical thought is you only go around once, you better do it right. Forget the gusto and do what is right. Do what is sound. You only hit it once. The thing with marriage is, you see, marriage is one of those things that you never get rid of. You know, people think, I'll marry somebody and if I don't like it, we'll get a divorce. You don't just wipe people out of your life that easily. Usually, I would say 90% of the time, the original marriage has lifelong continuing implications to it, even if there's a divorce, especially if there are children in the matter. But more than that, it's a lifelong thing. So what the person winds up with is two mates or three or four, whatever the box score is. I had a situation which was someone been married several times. And that was all before they were Christian. You have to look at a lot of things like that, weigh the situation, because people do things before they're Christians that sometimes the Lord just has to forgive them for and go on. But anyway, this person been married a number of times, and then they were now a Christian, and here came someone into their life that they were contemplating marrying, and they sent the person to me. They wanted to get them straightened out in their head and so forth. So I listened to what that person was saying to me about the relationship that he had, and I said, well, you know, it's a funny thing. Those are exactly the same things that broke up the previous marriages. I said, you know what I would suggest to you? Get out while you can. Just go. Leave. Don't look back. I said, all she'll do is rip you up, so get out. Well, a person just bitter against me ever since. They can't say enough bad about me from that time on. Things here that in these marriage situations, people can make one or two bad decisions in their lives in those regards. Normally, these decisions we make are lifelong decisions, and they affect us. The point about it only is this, that we play around with our lives, and we get them all messed up, and they're sloppy, and all that before we come to Christ. So, okay, now that's past. Now you've come to Christ, you've got a new life. You probably will have effects from the old life, probably for some time. But still, now we have the opportunity to start anew with Christ. Now it is true even with Christian people who have lived carelessly. A lot of times Christian people make careless decisions. And so now you've come to this point, X. You've come to this night, tonight, and here you are, giving attention to the fact that you better make sound decisions, and you look back over some unsound decisions in your life and say, well, I've made some careless decisions. But now you're starting from tonight on, and this is the first day of the rest of your life, as the song goes. Not a bad thought. So here we are, the first day of the rest of our lives. And now we can say to ourselves, I've played around with my life. I'm in danger of making some other mistakes. I'm going to really put my decision-making before Christ and ask Him for guidance from here on in. And then you just start that. From tonight on, just determine that these decisions, you're going to ask Christ for guidance, and you're going to follow it. You're going to follow it. You say, well, I can't be sure. Well, you can be sure enough to make it worth the gamble. It's better to gamble on that than gamble on you. So you do the best you can. You pray and you say, now, and here's a way to make them. You say, Lord, here's this decision. I don't know what to do. My own human capacity isn't enough. I can't reason it out. I don't know even how to find your will. But here I am. I want to make a decision. I want you to help me. Now, when you've prayed that way, just put it aside until the time to make the decision. Put it aside. All you're going to do is confuse yourself. You keep going back and forth and back and forth over the reasons. Because you'll get three reasons today and three opposing reasons tomorrow and three opposite reasons the next day. Okay? So you just wear your brain out. So don't worry about it. Pray about it. Do whatever primary thinking you have to do. It's all right to do some preliminary thinking and look at all the angles. But once you've reviewed them, you've gone over them, and you commit it to Christ, then comes the day of decision. Now you just say, oh, Lord, you're going to just have to see that I make the right choice here. And you make it. You'll have some sense within you. If you should say no in the matter, you'll feel uneasy about it. If you feel uneasy about a certain decision, don't make it. If you've prayed about it. If you've prayed about it and you feel uneasy, don't make it. I mean, just say no or postpone it if they'll let you. Postpone it until you do feel easy about it. And if you just keep feeling uneasy, just forget it. Now, if you come to that time and you feel no check or restraint from making the choice, you go ahead and make it. Now, after you've made it, leave it. Leave it alone. Don't Monday morning quarterback it. Just leave it alone. You've got friends that'll, you got all kinds of friends come rushing around. Oh, you forgot to think about this. You made a terrible decision. Didn't you think about this? Oh, why not? Well, I guess the Lord didn't want me to think about it. The Lord wants you to know something about a situation. He'll see that you get the knowledge of it. And if you don't get the knowledge of it before you make your decision, you probably were not supposed to know. Because you might have made a wrong choice. You might have gone on your own logic. This is a purely a figurative illustration. It has nothing to do with spirituality at all. Here's the stock market. You're going to put some money in a certain stock. You've watched all the various aspects of it, checked the market and so forth, and you come to a conclusion that this is a pretty good stock to buy. I'm going to say you could pray about it, because let's say there's nothing wrong with making a little money in the stock market. It's better than making it on the horses. So you're going to put a little money into the market. See? You got a windfall from Aunt Hilda who died, and then you got $40,000. Don't invest anything less than that, because you're just playing games, you know. But see? So you look at this stock, and you look it over, and you think that's a very good stock. So But you pray about it, see. Now, just before you go to buy the stock, you get a check on it. Don't buy that stock. So you don't. You turn it down. Now your buddy who's also playing the market comes over and he says, hey, by the way, did you see yesterday's paper? No, I didn't see the paper. Why, such and such a stock went up 2 points. And you say, oh, I could have bought that and I didn't, see. And so... See, right away you go back and say, wait a minute, if the Lord had wanted me to know that it went up and it was a good buy, He might have let me see that. But He didn't let me see that, so maybe I shouldn't have anyway. Okay, and so maybe it went up 10 points and you're really sexy. But okay. You think, oh, I made a mistake. I should have read that paper. See? But then you don't know that the following month the thing's going to drop 20 points. See what we're trying to say to you? That things that are facts that maybe the Lord keeps you from knowing because If you know it, it'll affect your decision, and he doesn't want that decision affected that way. Now, maybe you buy the stock, and then somebody says, hey, did you know that stock fell 10 points yesterday? Okay, then you're really sick. Or maybe it goes up 20 the next month. You can't outguess these things. Now, I use that just as a very sort of nonsensical thing, but when it comes down to really important decision-making, that's the way you have to look at it. The Lord brings facts to your attention that will help you to make a right decision, or he withholds facts that might cause you to make a wrong decision. And when those facts come to light afterward, don't use them as a guide. Don't go back on your decision. Maybe you feel the Lord wants you to do something, and then you make the choice, and then you get a lot of flack or emotional upheaval from different ones. And you say, oh, I guess I shouldn't have done that. I didn't know it would affect them that way. Well, the Lord didn't want you to know it would affect them that way. You might not have made the right choice. You make your choice in terms of what the Lord wants, not what other people want. Do what you believe is right, and then don't go back on it. I've followed that for some time, and I have to say to you that if you might somehow make a mistake by going that way, you're going to make far fewer. You'll make far fewer mistakes sticking by your guns than you will if you keep changing around. That's maturity. Make your choice and stay with it. Don't flop back and forth on it. I didn't know that in the earlier years of my life. I wish somebody had taught me some of that. I didn't know that, but I know that now. And I can pass it on to you. What are we talking about here? Are we not talking about the importance of making our life in terms of Christ, that the implication of our lives is that this old world is a very fleeting experience, and we better make our choices as Christ wants them, and we'll save ourselves a lot of headaches and a lot of heartaches. Now, going on to chapter 5 and verse 1, now these are the people that have made their choice to follow the things of this world. And they have ignored God. And he says, come now, you rich, weep and howl at your wretchedness, which is coming upon you. Your riches have rotted out. Your clothes have become moth-eaten. Your gold and your silver has rusted down through. That's what that word means, rusted out. And their rust shall be for a witness to you, and your flesh has been eaten as fire. Or perhaps we'd even say, and the gold and silver shall eat your flesh as fire. It could be that way. You've laid up treasures in the last days. That is, you've set your the consequences up for the last day. Behold, the reward of the workers who have reaped your fields, from whom you have withheld by guile. The cries of the reapers have come unto the ears of the Lord of hosts. You have lived luxuriously upon the earth and been wanton. You have fattened up your hearts for the day of slaughter. It's a good way to translate that. You've gorged your hearts for the day of slaughter. You have condemned and killed the just, and they have not resisted you. So here is the contrast with the person who has put all of his focus upon this world. It's interesting that he says to them, your goods have become rotten and rusted and so forth. He puts it in the past, even though they now are rich, yet in a sense, the rust has already begun. The doom is sealed as long as they keep going the way they are. The net result of their riches to themselves is already showing the effects of the rottenness. And their soul is being rotted out. Their focus upon this world's position and goods has spilled over to the people. People who have their focus too strongly on this world's ambitions or goods or themselves affect and hurt other people. That's, of course, the great problem of selfishness, self-centeredness, is that it hurts others. You may start out by, like, for example, the young person who keeps saying, well, it's my life, I'm going to live it the way I want. Now, that's a completely idiotic attitude, because nobody's life is really their own. They're going to affect other people. They can't help but affect other people. So they may start out going a course that only has to do with their own self-interest, but invariably that attitude spills over in their relationship to other people, and they become hard and self-centered. They have attitudes that hurt others. You can't put your focus on this life without affecting your capacity to relate properly to other people. The man, for example, who has an ambition to build a business of some kind, his focus is on money and is on his worldly ambition. He's going to hurt people around him. He's going to hurt his family. He's going to hurt others. The person who has their focus on a career of some kind, on self-interest of some kind, they're going to hurt other people around them. So this mercenary attitude, this commercial, mercantile attitude, spilled over to their attitude toward others, and they finally, if they start out merely being, say, ambitious for worldly gain, they end up by ultimately condemning and putting to death the just, you see. It starts so simply in selfishness. It ends in destroying others. Selfishness of one person can breed destruction through a whole body of people. This is the contrast, then, and James is showing it very pointedly here. You have only one life to live. It goes very, very fast. See to it that on this earth your life is lived in terms of what Christ wants. He goes on to say in verse 7, then, be long-suffering, therefore, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. Behold, the vine dresser receives the precious fruit of the earth, and he has long suffering upon it until he receive the early and the latter rain. Be you also long suffering. Establish your hearts, because the coming of the Lord has drawn near. Very interesting statement. It has drawn near. The coming of the Lord has drawn near. Whether we're talking about a few years or a few hundred years, the coming of Christ was then and is today a very present reality. God had finally come in the person of Christ, and the first coming was only a breath away from the second coming. The first coming of Jesus was the end, really. That was just the beginning of the fulfillment of God's purpose, whereas man had gone for thousands of years on the earth without that presence of Christ. Now the first coming of Jesus to the earth is the beginning of the end. We tend to think of the second coming and the first coming in different vein of thought, but we ought to see them as one unit, as God having drawn near. And he's with us today. That's why I'm not so worried about the pie in the sky by and by, because Jesus has come and Christ is with us today in our hearts, now, here. He's already drawn near. Therefore, we ought to take knowledge of that and establish our hearts and be long-suffering. That is, endure your life with Christ now, whatever the difficulties are. Do not be, it's very hard to translate this, but don't put pressure on your brethren, on one another, lest you judge. The word means to be straitened, that is to be between a rock and a hard place, to be pressed on either side, to be in a tight spot. Don't keep putting your brothers and sisters in a tight spot because of you, pressuring them for your own selfish interests, causing them difficulty, distress for your own selfish interests, because, he says, the Lord is near. He's drawn near. He's there. He sees all of that. The Lord sees the way we treat one another, and we treat each other unkindly or carelessly, selfishly, greedily, whatever. The Lord is aware of all of that. And there's recompense in the day to come. So as you expect the Lord to be long-suffering, or as we expect Him to be long-suffering with us, we ought to be long-suffering with one another. Patient, understanding, caring about one another.